Greetings, greetings, and further greetings, my fine listeners. Welcome to this October 2011 Science News Update. I'm your host for this evening of raw, explicit science, Jim Campanella. And let's get this puppy rolling. Okay, you may or may not remember from one of our broadcasts many months back, I told you guys about a web phishing scam that was designed specifically to lure scientists and academics into its less than subtle grasp. As I have said previously, I am fascinated by social engineering scams that are directed at scientists, since they seem the last people on the face of the earth who would fall for scams that are usually so transparent. Well, believe it or not, I've been challenged with another and much more sophisticated one of those scams. This one is entirely new and directed at scientists and MDs, and if I wasn't so mistrusting a guy, I may have actually fallen for it. So as usual, this scam came in the form of a very legitimate-looking email letter. Let me read you the short letter which was emailed to me. It starts off rather strangely with how they addressed themselves to me, which is probably what got my spidey sense tingling at first. Here it is. Oh, and I will use my right here to employ a silly accent because this has nothing to do with serious science. Dear Dr. Campanella JJ, it is with great pleasure we invite you to attend the first annual EPS Montreal International Gene Conference to be held November 3rd through 4th, 2011 in Montreal, Quebec, Canada. The conference will provide a forum for researchers in genetics and genomics to present cutting-edge research and learn about the latest breakthroughs and technologies. We would like to welcome you to our conference as our valuable speaker and present your recent work and ideas of population structure of Zostera marina on Western Atlantic coast is characterized by poor connectivity and inbreeding that were published in J. Herred. Please visit our website at www.epsglobal.ca to see program details. Montreal International Gene Conference is organized by EPS Global Medical Development, Inc. Professor Massaro, the editor-in-chief of the journal Cell Biochemistry and Biophysics, will be present at this event and call for submission of papers in this field. All papers presented at the conference may have a chance to be published in a special issue of Cell Biochemistry and Biophysics. You may be one of the lucky ones. EPS Global Medical Development, Inc. is a Canada-based biomedical consultancy agency that promotes continuing academic education, knowledge transfer, and scientific exchange through life sciences-oriented conferences. We are delighted to host the EPS Montreal International Gene Conference in Montreal in order to foster and promote excellence in genetics and genomics through education and research and to provide leadership in promoting development of evidence-based clinical genetics and genomics as well as the basic research that supports genetics and genomics and these clinical advances. We look forward to meeting you in Montreal and wish you all an enjoyable time. Warmest regards, Yao Lu, MD PhD, Executive Chair of Montreal International Gene Conference 2011, President of EPS Global Medical Development, Inc. Well, I felt good about that invite for about a nanosecond and was thinking of Sally Fields and her famous Academy Award phrase, "They like me, they really like me." Then practical reality hit. That missive has links to the EPS website, and it all looks pretty legit. They even have a serious-looking Facebook page. The only problem is that this is not ever how speakers are invited to conferences. First, they are usually invited to conferences by either a committee of scientists or part of a scientific organization, like, for example, the American Society of Plant Biologists, to which I'm a member, or the International Society of Microbiologists, etc. If you're not invited by the organizers, who you have actually heard of, you may be invited by a single scientist who is chairing a specialized session at a conference. For example, if your specialty is malarial transmission in scarlet capuchin monkeys of Ghana, and the conference session is on tropical diseases of Central African primates. You get the idea. And again, usually the person contacting you about the conference is well known in your field. Otherwise, they themselves would not have been made an organizer. The second problem is that if you are a conference organizer and you are asking a scientist to speak, you offer them not only free access to the conference, all conferences must charge in order to get their venues paid for, but also paying for travel to the conference as well. And in addition, in some cases, honoraria are offered to major hammers in the science fields. For example, if you're a Nobel laureate, you have the right to have your precious time paid for. It was immediately obvious that the EPS invitation was from no one I had ever heard of before, and they made no offers of remuneration of any kind. I immediately forwarded the invite to my wife and a couple of my colleagues who had the same response as me. In fact, one of them wrote back and said, quote, "Jim, I'm not sure I would take that invitation. You will probably wake up the next morning in a bathtub of ice with no kidneys." Unquote. My lovely wife, ever the practical one, did me one better and did a quick internet search to find out more about EPS and its conferences. She found out that EPS hosts the same first annual conference in multiple fields: neurosurgery, trauma surgery, genetics, community health care, epilepsy, infectious diseases, genomics, epigenomics. Okay, this was getting more suspicious at this point. I wrote them back, mostly out of curiosity, to see what their response would be. "Dear Dr. Yao Liu, thank you for your invitation. I'm happy for the opportunity to participate in EPS Global First International Genetics Conference as a guest speaker. However, I would like to know if all my expenses, accession to the conference, round-trip airfare, and hotel, will be underwritten by the organizing committee of the conference. In addition, I would also like to know what the time of day and the duration of my presentation would be. Kind regards, Dr. James Joseph Campanella, Ph.D. The response was this: "Dear Dr. James Joseph Campanella, thank you very much for your interest in the EPS Montreal International Gene Conference to be held November 3rd through 4th, 2011 in Montreal, Quebec, Canada. The presentation is in formal oral format in English or Chinese, and the duration should be around 10 to 15 minutes. If you confirm your participation, please let us know as soon as possible and send us your CV with photo, presentation topic, and abstract before September 30th. The registration fee is now $800 US, and the accommodation was originally not included. However, as a guest speaker, you only need to pay the registration fee. The hotel accommodations during the conference in Montreal would be free as a privilege, as well as local transportation and airport pickup. Meanwhile, if you present in the conference, we will provide you with further collaboration opportunities with international colleagues. Please find the detailed information in the attachment. We reserve the right for any change. We look forward to seeing you in Montreal, Canada. Warmest regards, Miracle Law, assistant to Dr. Yao Liu, EPS Global Medical Development, Inc." Miracle Law? Is that Dr. Miracle Law? Is that actually supposed to be a name? Anyway, this little interchange screamed scam at me. After doing some more internet digging, it appears that hundreds of scientists have been offered a chance to speak at an EPS conference, and they all have pretty much the same experience as me. In fact, I just got another invite from EPS. This time, it's to the, quote, first annual EPS International Diabetes Conference in Montreal, Canada. And it was exactly the same invitation, just another field of science. Same place, no credible details about the conference, no final detailed program or list of speakers, just 1 month prior to the conference, no committees, no details on the web. And I am a plant geneticist who does nothing remotely related to diabetes. This is a scam, a sting, to get your $800 transferred directly to the bank account of some crooks. And apparently, there is no international authority to investigate the case and stop these liars. I am amazed and amused by the whole thing, but at least most scientists seem to be aware enough to mistrust the whole matter. Unfortunately, as I have said previously, scientists are just as prone as anybody else to be scammed if things look legitimate enough and they are complimented enough. Why don't we talk some real science? This nonsense is overstaying its welcome. There are several very cool real stories to tell you about tonight. The first actual story is about a strange type of molecule called microRNA. Now, I suspect most of you have never heard of microRNA. MicroRNA has been discovered and characterized in the last 15 years or so. If you remember your high school biology, you have messenger RNA, which carries messages from the DNA, transfer RNA, which carries amino acids to make proteins, and ribosomal RNA to make the ribosomes, which actually make proteins. Well, into this category comes the new microRNAs. These are short pieces of RNA, hence microRNA, of about 22 nucleotides in length, which actually have the ability to regulate whether genes are allowed to express by targeting the messenger RNAs for degradation. What that means is that they can essentially turn off a gene function by killing the message before it gets to be made into a protein. This is a very cool thing because it's another level of gene regulation that we were completely ignorant of until, well, relatively recently. But that is not the story. That is just the background. This is the story. Dr. Chen Yu Zhang, a molecular biologist at Nanjing University in China, has just published a study in the journal Cell Research. You have heard the old adage, you are what you eat. Well, this seems to be along the same lines. Zhang has found that microRNAs from common plant crops, such as rice and cabbage, can be found in the blood and tissues of humans and other plant-eating animals. One microRNA in particular, MIR168A, which is highly enriched in rice, was found to inhibit a protein that helps remove low-density lipoprotein, LDL, from the blood, suggesting that microRNAs can actually influence gene expression across kingdoms. That means, given the example, that it looks like that by eating certain foods, you may actually be up or down regulating your own gene function. That means turning your own genes on and off and affecting your health without even realizing it. And we're not talking the obvious things here, like simply eating a high-fat diet and increasing your cholesterol. We're talking about a whole very subtle world of control and regulation that we didn't even realize was out there until Zhang's paper suggested it. There was a recent discovery in the last year that microRNAs circulate in the blood by hitching a ride in small membrane-encased particles known as microvesicles. Because of this finding, there's been a surge of interest in microRNAs as a novel class of biomarkers for a whole bunch of diseases. Dr. Zhang was studying the role of these circulating microRNAs in health and disease when he discovered that microRNAs are present in other bodily fluids, such as milk. Quote, "My discovery gave me the crazy idea that microRNAs from ingested foods like milk could also be found circulating in the serum of mammals," he says. To test his hypothesis, Zhang sequenced the blood microRNAs of 31 healthy Chinese subjects and searched for the presence of plant microRNAs. Plant microRNAs are structurally different from those of mammals, so they react differently to certain chemicals. Zhang and his team were able to differentiate the two by treating them with a chemical, sodium pyridate, which oxidizes mammal microRNAs, but not plant microRNAs. To their surprise, they found about 40 types of plant microRNAs in the test subject's blood. Even more amazing, some of those plant microRNAs were found in concentrations that were comparable to major human microRNAs expected in the blood. The plant microRNAs with the highest concentrations were recognized as ones called MIR156A and MIR168A. Both of those are known to be enriched in rice and cruciferous vegetables such as cauliflower, cabbage, and broccoli. Furthermore, the researchers detected those two microRNAs in the blood, lungs, small intestine, and livers of mice in variable concentrations that significantly increased after the mice were fed raw rice, although cooked rice also was shown to contain that intact MIR168A molecule. These microRNAs were found to interact with the mRNA of the protein which produces the LDL receptor and targets it for destruction. What that does is reduce the ability of the animal to clear, quote-unquote, bad cholesterol from their blood. These protein levels decreased in the livers of live mice 3 to 7 days after eating fresh rice or being injected with synthetic MIR-168A. This significantly increased LDL in the blood and also increased cholesterol. When the researchers injected the mice with an RNA sequence that bound to and neutralized MIR-168A, the protein and LDL levels returned to normal. This is absolutely incredible to me, and the health and treatment implications are astounding. Although Zhang has a long haul before he can elucidate the mechanisms by which plant microRNAs can regulate gene expression in humans, these astounding initial results promise to increase our understanding of how specific ingredients in food can mediate health and disease. Zhang says that he is certain that other researchers will find more microRNAs in food that have major effects on health, and I have absolutely no doubt that he is correct. Next story, still on the topic of food. Dr. Keiko Abe of the University of Tokyo reported a week ago in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences on a topic of interest to those of us who find the taste of certain healthy vegetables repulsive. Abe has finally explained how a little red berry called the miracle fruit makes just about anything from the sourest lemon to the bitterest beer taste sweet as honey. It appears that a protein in the fruit tickles the tongue's sweet-sensing machinery and intensifies sweetness in the presence of acidic flavors like those found in citrus fruits, as well as bitter flavors. So-called foodies have known the effects of the miracle fruit, Ricardella dulcifica, for a long time. I have read that these people have, quote, flavor-tripping parties, which, by the way, sounds to me very reminiscent of something from the 1960s where the guests are actually dropping acid or something to test its effects. These foodies will pop a berry and then chew for a while, coating their mouth and tongue with its fruitiness. Then the sampling begins. They report that Guinness Stout tastes like a chocolate shake. Tabasco hot sauce loses its spicy heat and instead tastes sour. They eat lemons and limes, which allegedly gush with sweetness. Hence, they call this a miracle fruit. And while the active ingredient in the miracle fruit, something called miraculin, has been known for decades, it hasn't been obvious how this protein confers sweetness. Now Dr. Abe has found miraculin's interaction with the tongue's sweet sensors depends on the acidity of the local environment. At an acidic pH of 4.8, neutral water, remember, is a pH close to 7, the sweet-tasting cells respond twice as vigorously to miraculin than they do at a less acidic pH of 5.7. At a closer-to-neutral pH of 6.7 and higher, the protein seems to shift slightly in shape and block the sweet sensors, but not activate them. That explains why under certain conditions, sweet foods may taste less flavorful after eating the berry. Probably the strangest thing about this protein is its ability to interact with the sweet sensors of the tongue. You don't generally think of proteins as having this ability. I mean, think of a nice juicy steak. They don't taste sweet, do they? Plants pack their fruits with sugars to entice animals to gobble them up and distribute the seeds inside. This is why fruit is sweet. But if a plant can't produce enough sugar because a berry is tiny, it uses a trick, and it uses protein instead of sugar to deliver the sweetness needed to be noticed by the animals. It's a way to trick the animals into thinking the berry is sweet when it is not sweet. Researchers are pushing the U.S. Food and Drug Administration to approve the protein's use in food. The FDA, however, is not exactly sanguine about how practical the use of this stuff is. I mean, basically, it's a protein. Proteins fall apart if heated. That sensitivity would make it a poor candidate for use in baked goods or just in general, most foods. So at least for the moment, miracle fruit is limited to use in fresh foods, which makes its applications kind of restricted to weird tasting parties and avant-garde restaurants. Okay, here's a short but interesting story that not everything that biologists take for granted is always true. Dr. Nicholas Fuchs, a chronobiologist at Karlsruhe Institute of Technology in Germany, just published a paper in PLOS Biology that demonstrates one of biology's basic ideas about life on Earth ain't necessarily so. For decades, it's been believed that every organism on the face of the Earth has a circadian internal clock rhythm of 24 hours. All chemical and biological rhythms in plants and animals are based on that daylight clock that has been bred into our DNA for millions of unchanging years. Well, now folks has found an exception. Cavefish are ancient, scaleless, and live in total darkness and lack any pigment. Folks has discovered that these cavefish have another unusual feature, a circadian rhythm body clock of 47 hours. That is about twice the length of most animals, including humans. Normally, the most important factor that regulates circadian rhythm is sunlight, but Folks writes that the cavefish's clock is totally blind to light. He says, quote, they have lived for millions of years completely isolated from the day-night cycle of the Earth. The researchers collected cavefish living beneath the Somali desert. They exposed the fish, along with zebrafish, to a day-night cycle. Only the zebrafish responded. The photoreceptor genes in the cavefish did not respond to light at all. In other words, says Folk, their clocks are blind. But even though the clocks are blind, they are nonetheless functional. Folks found that he could regulate the cavefish circadian clocks by creating a regular feeding schedule, finding that their clocks are there, but just not light sensing. He said additionally that, quote, this research is providing new information about the evolution of circadian clocks and the effect of constant darkness. We are really looking at evolution of biological clocks at a gene level here, unquote. I will finish the night with an update on exoplanet research, which we have been following for the last couple of years, actually. Astronomer Dr. Francesco Pepe of the Geneva Observatory and his team are publishing a study this month in the journal Astronomy and Astrophysics that presents his team's long-awaited characterization of the detected exoplanet population. These planet hunters have found more than 50 new planets, including at least 16 not much bigger than Earth, and one small gleaming chunk, a 3.6-fold Earth-mass planet parked just inside its star's life-friendly zone. Pepe says, quote, we can say that most of the stars have planets, and most of them have low-mass planets at this point. Pepe and his team use the HARP system to find distant worlds by focusing on wobbly stars that are being pulled in different directions by orbiting bodies. The update brings the team's 8-year discovery total to more than 150 planets. The findings report that more than 50% of stars like the Sun include planets orbiting around them. The smallest of these planets, with masses between Earth's and Neptune's, occur as part of entire planetary systems, and not usually by themselves. Pepe says, quote, the latest data suggests that roughly 70 to 80% of low-mass planets might live in multi-planet neighborhoods, unquote. One of the surprising findings of the new paper suggests that lighter planets are more common in extrasolar systems than heavy Jupiter-like ones, because up until these findings, astronomers were detecting mostly the big planets. Remember the Drake equation that calculates the likelihood of extraterrestrial life? The results of these studies will be useful in changing the variables in that calculation to make it more accurate, because the equation considers, among other factors, the fraction of sun-like stars in the galaxy that host planets and the fraction of those planets that are Earth-like. These new results will give us a better idea of how many Earth-like planets there actually may be. While surveys have not yet detected any actual Earth-mass planets yet, the HARPS Observatory previously detected a planet with only 1.8 Earth masses, which is pretty close, and the newly discovered planet, HD 855-12b, which lives in the habitable zone around its star in the constellation Vela, is only 3.6 Earth masses. Within the next 10 years, astronomers hope to aim new extremely large telescopes at target exoplanets to detect the presence of oxygen and other biomarkers in their atmospheres from across intergalactic space. But at the moment, there are no instruments that can do that. We just have to be patient. Well, that's all from me for now. As always, take care. Don't turn down any invites to a miracle fruit tasting party. And do not accept any invites from EPS if they email you. and I hope I've inspired some of you. Until next time, this is Jim Campanella.